Good morning and welcome to Studio 619. I'm Rick Howlett. Coming up later in today's program, we'll hear reaction following the local screening of the new documentary on the Iraq War called Meeting Resistance. First, for 25 years, crime fiction fans have followed the cases of Detective Kinsey Millhone, the wry, self-deprecating lead character in the alphabetical mystery series of author Sue Grafton. Grafton, who's a Louisville native, just released her 20th Millhone novel, T is for Trespass. She spoke with WFPL's Susan Sweeney Crum about the character, the series, and the future.
I'm very excited to be talking to you because I have read a number of the books. Now, I'm a little bit obsessive, so normally I feel like I have to read everything in order.
From the beginning, right?
Yes, and I haven't, and I've missed several in the middle. But I have been reading T. Uh-huh. And I think for a person who probably has never read them before, and they open the book and they realize they're in 1980-something,
Yeah. That
may surprise them. And that my first thought is, where does that come from, that you're still writing, that you write her set back in the 1980s?
It was a trap I set for myself, and I knew it was happening, but when I wrote A is for Alibi, how did I even know I'd get that one published? You know, it was all a projection on my part. A is for Alibi was published in May of 1982. The story takes place in May of 1982. And then B takes place in June of that year. I realized that if she aged 1 year for every book, she would be 80 years old by the time I got to the end. And I just thought it would be absurd to keep her credibility. I needed also to keep her young and fit. If you think 37 is young, which I think is very young. So I made the conscious choice to age her 1 year for every 2.5 books. So Kinsey Millhone, when I get to the end of the series, it will be the narrative year 1990, and she will turn 40. Oh. I just think it's perfect.
That is. It all comes together very nicely.
Exactly.
How do you remember things, though, from, like, fashions? And how do you consciously remind yourself, oh, she can't just pick up her cell phone and make a phone call?
Well, that I'm clear on. And the Internet, I'm clear, did not exist in those days. Computers, really, I remember having a personal computer in 1982. She's a little bit computer illiterate, but you may see her get slightly into that. I am having to start to do research. You would be surprised. To me, 1987, 1988 feels like day before yesterday. But technology has moved us so swiftly that I'm writing historical novels, face it.
Yeah.
So it's sort of fun. The joy of it is that she is an old-fashioned detective. Kinsey Millhone does not have technology on her side, and the truth is, even with the technology, it always comes down to law enforcement using their intelligence and their organization and their knowledge of criminal behavior to put a case together. The technology helps, but basically you got to have somebody making those judgments.
I got a laugh reading one of the references talking about someone's furniture and the stretchy one-size-fits-all slipcover on the couch. And I remember those because they were in our house. And I thought, well, and how do you keep those kind of things in your mind?
Well, I have a mind full of trivia. I forget all the important things. But those just stuck in my memory. A lot of things that I've seen in my life, like, ew, yuck.
Mm-hmm.
Those were not attractive things to have on your furniture,
But
maybe it's better than the clear plastic some people have.
Right. Well, tell me a little bit about Kinsey's personality. You say she's 37 years old, but she's got a little bit of a wise guy in her, it sounds like. Where does that come from?
Yeah, she's been married twice and divorced twice, and so she's very wary of men, and she's kind of cautious about herself. But she's also wry and self-deprecating, and she has a wicked sense of humor. She really, I think, part of what people relate to is she just says the things the rest of us are thinking. You know,
mm-hmm.
Stuff that's not even polite. But I don't do graphic violence. I don't do anything gory or nasty, but I do cuss a little bit. Not me, Kinsey Millhone, of course. But
is her personality at all an extension of yours, or are you all?
Yes. The difference is this. I am much more domesticated than Kinsey Millhone. I do love quarter pounders with cheese, but I don't eat them anymore because it would make my fanny wide. I did jog for 25 years. Now I walk 5.4 miles a day, 5 days a week.
Wow.
So we are sort of on the same wavelength. I also was married and divorced twice, but I have husband number three. I've had him for 30 years. He is just an angel. And I have children, whereas she does not. So there are primary differences, but I think her quick mouth and her jaded eye are part of me.
Tell me how you see how she has evolved in only a few years of her life, but in 20 years, as you've been writing her, 15 years, how you see her evolving, and can you tell us anything that you see will come?
Well, it's odd for me because other people read these books and they say, oh, Kinsey's so melancholy in this book, or, you know, but since I write from the inside out, I can't always make calculations about how she's perceived. I don't sit down and say, in this book, I think she's going to do X, Y, and Z. I just open my heart and let her do as she will and let other people make the judgments about her. Most of what I do is try to get out of my own way so that she can live her life as long as the pages last. So I suppose she's gotten slightly more mellow. She's had a romance or two that have not gone particularly well, but she likes guys, you know, and she's always thinking maybe it'll turn out okay. Mm-hmm. At the same time, she is a loner, and she enjoys her privacy and her space, and so she's got a sort of dilemma on her hands. She owns the one dress. In our ricochet, she could get a skirt or two. I was real happy. She cuts her hair with a pair of nail scissors, whether it needs it or not. You know, she's very down-to-earth and unpretentious, and she's just fun to have in my life.
Where did the alphabet idea come from? And when you wrote A is for Alibi, did you intend to do 26? And what happens after Z?
Well, that's a long set of questions. First of all, when I decided to write a detective novel, I thought, well, let's have linking titles. John D. MacDonald linked his titles with colors. Mm-hmm. There was a guy named Harry Kimmelman who did Days of the Week. And I knew at the back of my mind that publishers liked it because it was a clue to the reader that a new book was out. So I was reading an Edward Gorey cartoon book, little pen and ink drawings of Victorian children being done in various ways. This book is called The Gashly Crumb Tinies. It's very funny. And this went A is for Amy, who fell down the stairs, B is for Basil, assaulted by bears, C is for Claire, who died of ennui. And by then, the light bulb had gone on above my head. And I thought, why can't you do a series of crime novels based on the alphabet? So I sat down and sketched out as many letters as I could because I wanted to make sure I didn't get halfway through and run out of subject matter. And many of those titles have remained. A was always for Alibi, B was for Burglar, C was for Corpse. So sometimes a book will come along and I change the title, or I'll sometimes give myself five choices and see what the story is. As for being, what I'm going to do when I get to Z is for Zero, I say two things. I'm going to take the longest nap on the planet, and I'm going to party.
Oh, you finally get that.
It's going to be just such an amazing day. But I got years to go yet. I just got to keep myself fit.
Uh-huh. Do you see more books with a whole different direction coming?
No. I keep saying, when I get to Z is for Zero, I will have proved my point. I will be close to 80. Oh. I kid you not. And I think I'm entitled to a really fine vacation.
I think so, too. You get to relax and enjoy yourself for a while.
Now, the truth is, I may write about Kinsey if there are other tales to tell, but I will never do linking titles again. I have learned my lesson.
Well, don't do the whole alphabet anyway. That's 26.
I know. Exactly.
I don't want to keep you too long, but just tell me again a little bit. I think you're Louisville's one of our claims to fame here, and I think we're proud to say that this is your home, at least for part of the year, and that you grew up here.
Yes.
Tell me a little bit about how you keep the connection here and how important that is to you.
For one thing, I went to the University of Louisville and graduated with a BA in English. I have classmates that go all the way back to kindergarten. So when we do a high school reunion, there are classmates that have followed me. We went to Little Iron Blue, Big Iron Bloom, Highland Junior High School, Atherton. And it's fun to get our pictures taken. There are 10 or 12 of us left. You know, my high school class is much larger than that. But it's just a lovely town. People are just so gracious, and I come mostly spring and fall, so I get the best of the weather. When it gets too hot or too cold or the bugs get too big, I go back to California. But it really matters. It's been fun to watch the changes that Louisville has exhibited over the years. I think it's a very sophisticated city. You know, it's not big, and it's not like New York, which is kind of nasty. Mm-hmm. Don't tell I said that. But it's got such charm and such personality.
There's a lot going on right now. It's a pretty exciting time to be here in Louisville, I think, with what's going on.
That was WFPL's Susan Sweeney Crum with author and Louisville native Sue Grafton. You can find out more about Grafton or any of the books in her series by visiting our website, WFPL.org. Recent testimony from a legislative committee in Frankfort indicates Kentucky is making progress in the battle against methamphetamine production, but still faces challenges in cleaning up property contaminated by meth labs. Kentucky Public Radio's Tony McVeigh has the story.
Commonly called speed, crank, ice, or crystal, methamphetamine is an illegal drug that can be swallowed, inhaled, smoked, or injected. It affects the central nervous system and can cause a false sense of well-being, impaired speech, hallucinations, aggressiveness, and loss of appetite. Long-term effects include liver and brain damage, insomnia, stroke, and even death. Meth is usually manufactured or cooked in small, unsophisticated, clandestine labs. Kentucky State Police Major Mike Sapp says meth production spread into western Kentucky from Missouri, and between 1999 and 2002, the number of meth labs in Kentucky doubled nearly every year.
People manufacture the meth for their own use and enough to sell to their friends, so they can buy their ingredients and find the ingredients to come back and make another batch.
One of the main ingredients is pseudoephedrine, which is found in cold remedies. In 2005, Kentucky lawmakers made it harder to buy products containing ephedrine, and Major Sapp says that reduced the number of meth labs in Kentucky by 50%. But that still leaves the challenge of cleaning up the toxic mess left behind when labs are discovered. Lighter fluid, lacquer thinner, camera batteries, hydrochloric acid, sulfuric acid, and ammonia are just a few of the products and chemicals often found in meth labs. Until this year, the state had no standards or procedures for cleaning up such labs. But legislation sponsored by Representative Tanya Pullen took care of that, at least in regard to habitable dwellings.
Our primary goal is to thoroughly and finally clean up old meth labs to make homes. And ultimately, I believe we will address in the next session other things besides homes where meth has been cooked, safe for innocent children and adults.
Pullen and the House Public Safety Committee she chairs are studying how implementation of the law is going. Ashland firefighter Jonathan Pennington says it's having a positive effect.
The bill has allowed a structure to be put in place for the certification of meth lab cleanup contractors. And more importantly, the certificate that's issued afterwards is their bill of guarantee that actually something has been done and there's proof.
The law defines decontamination standards, requires the decontamination of properties by certified contractors, defines the role of police and local health departments in limiting access to fouled properties, and provides financial assistance for cleanup costs. But Bruce Scott of the Environmental and Public Protection Cabinet says funding is still a major issue.
Somebody has a property that's contaminated, they want to get it cleaned up, they call a certified contractor, and they say it's going to cost $5,000. And the homeowner or the property owner will say, I don't have that money, what do I do? That's been the overwhelming issue, trying to find adequate source of revenue or some sort of way to fund these properties to clean up so we can make them re-inhabitable.
At first, the state had difficulty finding qualified contractors capable of handling meth lab decontamination, but as of this month, there are now 5 certified companies. For Kentucky Public Radio, I'm Tony McVeigh in Frankfort.
Coming up next, the state of higher education in Kentucky. You're in Studio 619 on WFPL. Welcome back to Studio 619. I'm Rick Howlett. It's been 10 years now since higher education reform began in Kentucky. The Post-Secondary Education Improvement Act of 1997 also pinpointed areas of concern to be addressed by the year 2020. WFPL's Heidi Caravan discussed higher education concerns with Council on Post-Secondary Education's Interim President, Brad Calgill.
We need to talk about reform for a little bit first. Where were we? Where are we now and where are we going?
I like to say that in Kentucky, higher education is a goal-driven business. Heidi, and it's goal-driven because 10 years ago, when the General Assembly adopted House Bill 1, which was our Post-Secondary Education Reform Act, they embedded into the permanent law of the state of Kentucky some six goals that they want higher education institutions to advance and to achieve those goals by the year 2020. One of them, for example, here in the city of Louisville, is that the University of Louisville would become a premier metropolitan research institution, the University of Kentucky to become a top 20 research institution, and for each of the regional institutions to have a program of distinction. There are, as I say, a total of six goals. Where we stood as of 1997 was the realization that our state was very far behind the mainstream of the American economy in terms of our per capita income. And Governor Patton at that time wanted the state to focus first on the goal of bringing our average per capita income in Kentucky up to the level of the American mainstream within a realistic period of time. And the 23-year period that he identified at that point in time was believed to be realistic. He realized, and so did the General Assembly, that in order to achieve that goal, we would have to increase the percentage of people who live and work here in the state of Kentucky who have bachelor's degrees from an accredited college or university up to the American average as well. And the logic of that was fairly simple, and that is that when you look at the average lifetime earnings of people who have bachelor's degrees or more, they tend to be about $1 million more than the lifetime earnings of people who don't have college degrees. So what's true of individuals tends to be true also of individuals when they're grouped into states. And that is that if a high percentage of them have college degrees, they simply earn more money. And when they do that, Heidi, as you would understand, the benefit is not just to them. It's to the state as a whole, because those increased earnings will be taxed by the state's income tax. The property that they purchase with their increased earnings will be taxed at both the state and the local level. So the increased earnings, which flow more or less naturally from this, the more you learn, the more you earn sort of approach, would flow naturally to the communities and to the state as a whole.
Seems so simple. Education leads to better jobs, leads to more money. How do we get there? We've certainly come a long way in the past 10 years since 1997. Tell me about some of the initiatives that we adapted, and how did we get from 10 years ago to now, and how are we doing now?
Well, we've made a lot of progress. The general participation in higher education in Kentucky has increased dramatically. I think, first of all, one of the most the biggest success stories in post-secondary education in the last 10 years has been our community college system. It fits the needs of the state of Kentucky like a hand in a glove. It was conceived of as a way of taking a state with large numbers of people who were attracted to real-life opportunities in the workplace and whose academic or financial capacity was not unlimited, and providing them convenient opportunities, a highly accessible system. Our success in that has been tremendous. We've also had tremendous growth, not only in enrollment, but also in the stature of the institutions that comprise our system. The University of Kentucky, as I said, was tasked with responsibility for becoming a top 20 research institution. It has made a lot of progress toward that. The University of Louisville, I think, has been a tremendous catalyst here in Louisville for a lot of economic growth, frankly, that you're seeing right here in Jefferson County. The University of Louisville has had a big role in that. It has concentrated its own strategies very specifically in things that have a very high payback, including especially medicine and distribution. The other regional institutions have also had a big role to play, and they'll have a big role to play in the future as we go forward. One of the things that the Council on Post-Secondary Education has been focused on, now that we're 10 years down the road, is how we go from where we are now to our goal in the year 2020 of having as many, or at least as strong a percentage, of college graduates within our borders as we do in America as a whole. Now that we've come 10 years down this path, I think we can see more clearly than we did before how we get from where we are to where we said that we wanted to be by the year 2020. To that end, the Council has published a brochure, it's available at our website as well, called the Double the Numbers Plan, and it's intended to outline the five strategies that we will pursue as a state in order to increase the percentage of our population that have college degrees. That, it seems to me, is the essential role of the Council, is to develop plans for the achievement of goals that the state as a whole has adopted for itself.
Let's go through some of the questions about post-secondary education reform. First of all, are more Kentuckians ready for post-secondary education reform? It seems like a simple question, but it's really not, is it?
Well, it's not easy, and the answer is yes, but it's sort of a yes with a footnote. The number of students who start out as ninth graders and who end up graduating with a high school diploma on time is still disparagingly low in the state of Kentucky. That affects higher education, of course, because without a high school diploma, you are, generally speaking, not eligible to proceed into the world of post-secondary education. So one of the things that we'll need to do as a state is to strengthen our high school program, our K-12 program, so that we have fewer dropouts, that we've patched some of the leaks, as we sometimes say, in our educational pipeline, so that we get more high school graduates as a function of the number of ninth graders that that we had. So are they more prepared? Yes, but we've got a long way to go. And in fact, one of the biggest problems, Heidi, that we have is that in an effort to ensure that we have the human stock of capital that we need in order to get the number of degrees in Kentucky that we want, the institutions have been admitting as freshmen a lot of students who are not really ready for college. That is, all of the standardized tests on which we rely tell us that the student will need to take some remedial courses in order to participate in college-level courses actively and to succeed in those courses and to run the distance, if you will, all the way to a college degree. The number of students who come unprepared is discouragingly high, and that makes it necessary that at the college level we provide what we call developmental education. It's also referred to as a remedial education, but it means that at the college level we're pumping up study skills, reading skills, analytical skills, so that students in college will be able to do college-level work. So there's a cost associated with that, and it's a cost that we would wish could first be incurred within our K-12 program, because when we do it there, the cost of getting students ready for college is generally less.
Mm-hmm. We are getting there, though. Before grade 12, the new NAEP test numbers, for example, the readers in 4th and 8th grade in Kentucky, the percentage there has really grown a whole mm-hmm. lot. So we are doing some progress at the lower levels, but it needs to reach up and catch people in grade 12 and then the huge gap before people go to college.
True.
Let's talk a little bit about the cost of bringing education reform to Kentucky. What are the real numbers telling you?
Well, the cost of providing undergraduate services has increased dramatically over the course of the 10-year period of time since higher education reform was adopted. And over the course of that time, Heidi, we've sort of transformed as a state. If you were to go back as many as, say, 15 years, you'd find that Kentucky was what I'll call a relatively low tuition, relatively low financial aid state. Inch by inch and 1 year at a time, that has changed. The cost of providing higher education services has increased more rapidly And here I'm not talking about the price in the form of tuition. I'm talking about the actual cost mm-hmm. of providing the service in the form of salaries and so forth. All of that has increased more rapidly than the consumer price index has increased. But during that period of time, the amount of money available to higher education, that is, the amount of money available in the form of operating support to public higher ed institutions, when you combine that with the amount of public support for scholarships, has become smaller and smaller as a portion of the total cost. There was a time, for example, in the not too distant past, when the total cost was paid about two-thirds by the government and about one-third by the student in the form of tuition. Over a period of a relatively few years, we've now changed to the point where the student now pays about half the cost, and the taxpayers pay the other half. I'm referring now to the public universities, like the University of Louisville. As we look forward, it's going to be essential that we use our money as cost-effectively as possible for the purpose of keeping tuitions low enough that we can attract the volume of students to college that we'll need in order to achieve our goal, our 2020 double the numbers goal, with having that many additional college graduates living and working within our borders. So one of the things that has that's really been an important focus of attention at the council level in the adoption of our budget recommendation to the General Assembly. One of the main roles that the council plays is to be an advisor, an independent advisor to the General Assembly and to the governor on higher ed finance. And our recommendation this year will focus on using our funds from the state level as responsibly as possible so as to achieve that, so as to ensure that state goals are achieved.
Can we look ahead at the General Assembly session, which is just now a month and a half away, believe it or not? What are we going to see there as far as education is concerned? Any surprises, anything that citizens will look at and think, what are they doing there? Any kind of bills that will be coming up in the General Assembly session?
There is the possibility that there will be an interest on the part of the General Assembly in focusing on tuition issues generally. Right now, from the legislators that I've spoken with, I don't know that there will be a majority of the General Assembly who will be interested in any new initiatives in that regard. I say that in the context of the council's own recommendation that that it take responsibility for freezing tuition at the community colleges. We have 16 community colleges spread across the state, and as I indicated earlier, they're very successful. They've provided tremendous service to the state of Kentucky. But if you imagine for the moment that in the world of post-secondary education, there are different institutions and different programs like the rungs on a ladder, and we would always want the first rung, which in Kentucky is our community colleges, we would always want that first rung to be accessible to everybody. And here I mean everybody with a capital E. And tuition at the community colleges have been rising pretty much at the same percentages as they have at the regional and the research institutions. And we're concerned that that has now reached the point at which even the community colleges are becoming inaccessible to the sort of people that we want to be able to come to the community colleges. So we're going to propose to freeze that. That's one of the issues, I think, though, that the General Assembly will be interested in talking about. There are a couple of other initiatives. Again, these are all sort of in the budget category, but I really think these are likely to be the main points in the area of higher ed in the next session. The first is the Bucks for Brains program. We have had tremendous success in this state over the course of these last 10 years with Bucks for Brains. As you probably know, the way it works is that the state makes available a dollar-for-dollar match with money that comes from the private sector in the form of contributions to the university's endowment. A dollar from the state is matched with a dollar from a private contributor. It's usually more like $1 million from the state and $1 million from a particular contributor, and that's used to match a particular opportunity, usually in the area of research, to have a professor who may be one of the leading experts in his field and somewhere in the country, who will then come to one of our institutions, often in the company of several other graduate students or colleagues, and they set up shop, and the salaries are then paid from the income of the increased endowment that's been created by this Bucks for Brains program. It's been an enormously successful program, and it's swelled the endowments of our institutions all across the state, including especially the University of Louisville and the University of Kentucky. We have had three rounds of Bucks for Brains, and when I use the word round, what I'm talking about is that in order to get money into that program, the legislature needs to include an authorization within the budget. The last time that was done, I think, was in the year 2002, which is to say that we've now gone about 5 years without replenishing our tank for Bucks for Brains. The council has recommended a $200 million total authorization for Bucks for Brains on a multi-year initiative. That is to say that the funds would be made available on a phased or sequential basis. That would allow the university presidents to make plans on a multi-year basis as to how they want to best take advantage of this opportunity. But I think most people don't, you know, put new gas into their tank until the tank has run dry. The tank didn't run dry until fairly recently, but the tank is completely dry now, and I think the legislature will be very interested in refilling that tank because the program has been so successful.
Is there any fear of the Bucks for Brains program not being continued because of funding or any other reason?
I suppose there's the possibility of that, and I say that because looking forward at this moment, the state's budget picture is going to be fairly tight. Some 4 years ago, when Governor Fletcher was elected, I think most people in the country or in the state were fairly familiar with the fact that our budget was going to be extremely tight, and they expected some difficulty of bringing our budget into balance in the context of all the pressures, the increased costs of various programs that the government provides. The situation is not entirely different this time than it was 4 years ago, but I think one of the big differences is that I'm not sure people across the state are nearly as aware of that fact now as they were 4 years ago, but the sort of pressures that we have now are going to make balancing of the budget very difficult. This is not, all things considered, the ideal year for higher ed or for any other major programmatic initiative to be in the General Assembly trying to make a significant increase in an appropriation simply because the revenue is, from our perspective right now at least, going to be pretty tight. I tell people that not only can we afford it, we almost can't afford not to. When you see the return on investment that the state gets from increasing the volume of college graduates living within our borders, the return on investment is really quite incredible. And if we will go ahead and make that investment, the sooner we do, the sooner we'll be able to get the returns on the investment as well. And those returns, as I say, come in the form of a higher level of personal income across the state and thereby a higher level of tax revenue into the general fund.
Let's look into your crystal ball and talk about the year 2020. What do you see for Kentucky 13 years down the road?
Well, I think we will probably achieve this goal. I think we'll achieve it by virtue of the fact that we'll end up having to shift some strategies in a period of time between now and then. But when we achieve it, and as I say, that's a prediction. When we achieve it, that means that in the year 2020, we'll have living in Kentucky some 800,000 college graduates. That sort of brings to mind where this phrase, double the numbers, comes from. If we were to have in Kentucky, by that year, an equal percentage of college graduates as the rest of the country, that would be about 32%. And I say that because there are a lot of researchers right now who are predicting that in the year 2020, the country will have about one out of every three working-age adults who will have college degrees. Right now in Kentucky, we're somewhere in the vicinity of 19 or 20% of our working-age population has a college degree. And if we were to stay, if we didn't really change very much, then you would expect that to go to somewhere in the neighborhood of 24 or 25%. We'd be doing a lot better by the year 2020, but not as well as we hope to. Frankly, one of the reasons that the percentage gets better is that an older generation that tended to have a lot fewer college graduates in it simply passes on and is replaced by a younger generation where college attendance has been more typical. Some of that happens just by natural demographics. But the part that needs to happen as a product of affirmative state policy is the part that changes what would otherwise be 24% up to the same 32% that we expect the rest of the country to have by the year 2020. And the last year that we knew with certainty how many college graduates we had living in the state of Kentucky was the year 2000, and I say that because that was a census year. So we know that number fairly accurately, and at that year we had 400,000 college, right at 400,000 college graduates living in Kentucky. So the term double the numbers comes from the fact that if we in 20 years were to go from 400,000 college graduates to 800,000 college graduates, then we will have effectively won't be exactly the same people, obviously, but we will have doubled the number of college graduates living here, and we will have had a profound effect on the state economy. As a matter of fact, Heidi, I've said, and I believe it, that if we were able to transform our state over that 20-year period, it would be the most dramatic economic transformation in the history of the state. That is to say that if you could, by all of these processes, in over the course of 20 years, change this from a state where the percentage of college grads in Kentucky was one of the lowest in the country, to where we were actually in the middle, that is, we matched the rest of the country, one college grad for another, we will have achieved a dramatic economic transformation of our state.
That was Brad Calgill, the interim president of Kentucky's Council on Postsecondary Education. He was joined in the studio by WFPL's Heidi Caravan. Meanwhile, the Kentucky Chamber of Commerce has issued a report on postsecondary education compiled by a task force assembled last spring. You can find a link to that report on our website, WFPL.org. When we come back, Kristen Espelon has a report on the massive sewer upgrade underway in Louisville. You're in Studio 619 on WFPL. Welcome back to Studio 619. I'm Rick Howlett. Louisville's Metropolitan Sewer District is entering the next phase of a major project to upgrade its sewer system. The goal is to curb the millions of gallons of untreated sewage that spill every year into local waterways. WFPL's Kristen Espeland reports.
The plunk of fat raindrops hitting the ground may be music to the ears of gardeners, but that sound sets off alarm bells at the Metropolitan Sewer District, or MSD. Rain can overwhelm the city's treatment plants. Most of the older parts of Louisville use a combined sewer system. The system takes everything from what you flush to stormwater runoff in a single pipe to the treatment plant. Combined sewers were the best technology available at the time they were built, beginning around the 1860s. But what the pipes and plants can't handle gets released straight into the Ohio River. That's not ideal, but in wet weather, it is legal. Beneath most of the city's newer neighborhoods are separate sewer lines and storm lines. What's illegal is when sewer-only pipes overflow, and that's exactly what's been happening along Beargrass Creek.
We're talking about a total discharge of somewhere in the 150 million gallons per year range.
That's MSD contractor Gary Swanson at the agency's headquarters. Neighborhoods like Beechwood Village across from the St. Matthews Mall have separate sewer lines. And when it rains, groundwater seeps in and overwhelms the system. So a flap at the end of the pipes flips open to let the extra flow escape. right into the creek. Now, under the terms of a federal lawsuit, MSD must stop these illegal discharges from the four worst sites immediately. The suit, filed by the Environmental Protection Agency and the state of Kentucky in 2005, forced the city to tackle the worst of its sewer problems right away and then turn its attention to the rest of the system. Engineers are hitting the drawing boards right now to meet the first of many mandated deadlines. It's the beginning of one of the largest public works projects the city has ever seen. Engineer Gary Swanson says the problems they'll address, first in Beechwood Village, go back decades.
That whole subdivision was constructed in the 1960s in an area with very high groundwater, basements that were below the normal groundwater table, and sewers that were constructed poorly. MSD has put millions of dollars into trying to fix those sewers and has never been able to really make them perform properly.
The solution, Swanson says, is a brand new sewer system for the entire area. And if you live there, here's what that means.
Every street will be torn up, new pipes put in the middle of the street, and then will be in every house, every yard.
And that's just a fraction of the federally mandated fixes MSD must make. The agency must get a plan to address the rest of those fixes throughout the entire sewer system to the Environmental Protection Agency by December 2008. And the work is estimated to take nearly two decades. Most of the problems are those legal but undesirable discharges from the combined sewer system. Ideally, in wet weather, all the sewage and rainwater would flow together to one of the two major treatment plants, get treated, and then released into the Ohio River. But a visit to the Morris Forman Sewage Treatment Plant near Rubbertown reveals why that isn't always the case.
We have two flow streams. The one right underneath us is the Ohio River Interceptor. That's the one that comes from downtown, so that's where it all comes in together.
Engineer Alex Novak starts the tour from where combined sewage flows into the treatment plant. Every gallon of this smelly brown sludge will make about a three-day journey through a maze of gates and sieves and tanks, and that's on a dry day.
So the flow gets conveyed over here and goes into the big sedimentation basins.
Each step essentially removes more and more of the solids, including one turn through a special tank that employs bacteria to munch through those solids more thoroughly. The whole plant can treat around 300 million gallons a day, but when it rains and more flow is gushing into the plant faster than it can treat, some of these treatment steps get bypassed. Every drop will be sanitized with chlorine, but some solids will make it into the Ohio. And on the way to the plant, pipes throughout the combined system could overflow straight into the Ohio before treatment, legally, at more than 100 combined sewer overflow sites around the city. Luckily, that's not the case today.
So you can see at this point, it's pretty darn clear water, clearer than what's in the Ohio River right now. And so that's the end of our liquid stream. That's you're done at that point.
To reduce the number of overflows, MSD will try out a range of techniques. One involves trapping overflow that might have escaped in a section of giant sewer tunnel. Back at the agency's headquarters, engineer Angela Ackridge explains.
What we have already done to decrease the overflow is to route that flow and bring it around to the sewer that does have the capacity, shut the three large gates at the end of the pipe, and hold that flow in there to the point where Morris Forman has the ability to treat and process that flow completely.
To date, Ackridge says this storage system has kept nearly 600 million gallons of untreated sewage out of the waterways. But it's going to take more than that to control the problem. MSD will be separating some combined sewer lines. It will add pipes to increase the system's capacity, and it's enlarging a second treatment plant to be able to handle more volume. The price tag for now is $800 million. Regulatory Director Brian Bingham explains how much of that will come from the rates customers will pay.
100% or close to it. There is no federal money essentially available, and we've got no state money, so we're spending right now about $100 million a year.
How the city got to this point is a long story. Some parts of the sewer date back to Civil War times. Some fragments of pipe still in use are made of wood. But as for why it took a lawsuit to force MSD to clean up the system's major messes, Bingham says it took a lawsuit to justify the more expensive projects. He says the agency has already made several improvements, including upgrades to the Morris Forman plant. But he says they've moved slowly on other projects to avoid upsetting customers.
One of the things that we've tried to balance is the cost and rates versus the improvement of water quality.
That balancing act might have delivered cheap sewer service, but it seems to have come at the cost of clean rivers and creeks. Now, the city must pay up. For WFPL, I'm Kristen Espeland.
Earlier this month, Louisville audiences got to see a new documentary about the Iraq War that takes a controversial approach. It interviews Iraqis who are fighting American soldiers. WFPL's Elizabeth Kramer went to see the film and the reaction.
All the way down the hall on your right.
Ticket sales were brisk as audiences packed Baxter Avenue theaters for the new documentary, Meeting Resistance.
Second door on your right.
Thanks.
Some came because they knew this film was co-directed by Louisville native Molly Bingham, who worked on this project with fellow photojournalist Steve Connors. Others came to see if they could learn something new about the war in Iraq from this decidedly different documentary about the conflict. This is not an assortment of interviews with Americans and politicians providing the political bent of Michael Moore's Fahrenheit 9/11 or activist Robert Greenwald's Iraq Uncovered. Nor is this a telling of stories by soldiers serving in Iraq. Meeting Resistance is different because these filmmakers went behind enemy lines. In 2003 and early 2004, they went to Baghdad's Adamiya neighborhood and interviewed Iraqis who say they are insurgents. In the film, the Iraqis' faces are obscured, and there are many fleeting images of their hands. They are holding coffee cups, turning cigarettes between their fingers, and sometimes restlessly stroking their garments. Since Bingham and Connors finished the film early this year, they have shown it in selected cities nationwide and held discussions. They have shown it to students at West Point and to soldiers in Baghdad. They say both groups told them it provided insight into the Iraqi culture. That same sentiment is prevalent in the theater this evening. Dennis Brennan, a retired overseas civil servant for the United States Agency for International Development, is among them. Still, during the post-film discussion with Bingham and Connors, he found fault with the documentary.
And particularly I was concerned at the representation of the enormous violence that's visited on the Iraqis is not really portrayed very much. And that the role of the fact that this is very much a Sunni neighborhood is not given the kind of attention that it needed to put it in context.
For other viewers, the graphic images were jarring. One was of a dead child, and another was the charred corpse of an American being dragged through the street in Fallujah in 2004. Lane Adams says despite these scenes, the film gave her a better understanding of some Iraqis.
The dedication of the people to jihad, you know, to protect and defend their country, and the religious aspect of it.
It made Bellarmine University professor Adam Renner think about the role of this film in relation to what mainstream media is reporting.
At least it provides another perspective that we need to consider when we're talking about this issue. As many different lenses as we can look through to try to understand it, I think, just helps us be better informed. I don't know if we can know the truth about what's happening, but as many little truths as we can find out, the better.
Bingham and Connors are showing the film this month in other cities, including Chicago, San Francisco, and Washington, D.C. DVDs of the documentary are available at Ray's Monkey House on Bardstown Road. For WFPL, I'm Elizabeth Kramer.
More information about today's show is available online at WFPL.org. You can email us from there or listen to previous broadcasts in our audio archive. You can also write to us at Studio 619, 619 South 4th Street, Louisville, Kentucky, 40202. Or you can reach us by phone at 502-814-6500. Studio 619 is produced by the Public Radio Partnership. Everything you hear on Studio 619 is compiled by the staff at PRP, which includes WFPL, WFPK, and WUOL. We also air submissions from Kentucky Public Radio, a collaboration of all the public radio stations in the Commonwealth. Alice Thompson provides website direction. I'm Rick Howlett. Join us next time for another edition of Studio 619 on WFPL.